honors were more or less even, if my memory serves me right. I told him to come over this way on the off chance of getting a joyride. As a matter of fact, the joy part of the proceedings is usually one-sided, the pilot's side. More rain again this morning, indeed, an ideal dawn and very promising, as we remarked at breakfast. There are rumors, though as yet not officially confirmed, that the strength of the RFC is being reduced in the winter to 10 pilots per squadron, instead of the present strength of 12. The only way it would seem to affect the remainder would be that leave would come a week sooner each time, and very nice, too. At the present rate of progress, another 4 weeks or to see me home again. I had a very nice letter from Mrs. D. and G. yesterday, and of course one from you too. By the way, I forgot to mention that yesterday afternoon I had to do an aerial patrol over B, as the King was reviewing some troops there. Fearfully rough up, as we, H, and I, spent most of our time dodging thunderstorms, but in the absence of Archie the trip was distinctly pleasant. A perfect gale is in progress just now. The trees are shedding their leaves, while the rain is beating an infernal tattoo on the roof, which, being of canvas stretched on a wood frame, resounds like a drum. I have got an extensive stock of letters to polish off by tonight's post, so I'll shut down for the day. Love to all. This is Claude's last letter. He wrote a few lines on the 8th to say he would be home in a few days on leave, but he never came for he went out on the morning of the 11th November and did not return. He was reported missing, and it was nearly a month before he was known to have been killed in mid-air that morning, fighting two German aeroplanes. France, November 5, 1915. My darling mother, success at last. Had a real adventure, involving several minor ones in its train, and it was thus wise, yesterday being the first fine day, I had instructions to go up in an FE, with P, as observer, to take some photographs over X, about the most unpleasant job going, as the numerous woods about there are absolutely bristling with Archies of no mean prowess, as I can testify, having had, perforce, to sample some of their wares on many a reconnaissance of late. It took us, roughly, an hour to get up to 9,000 feet, which time we spent between Y and X, dash, climbing, climbing, and climbing still. The air was pretty full of machines, it being the first fine day for some considerable time. We saw no Huns, though we afterwards heard that there were three hanging about behind their lines, and worrying a number of our fellows doing photography. 20 to 12 found us east of X, dash, not far short of 10,000 feet up, and distinctly chilly. A biplane and a monoplane appeared east of us, the biplane leading, with ample evidence of being in a hurry, with the monoplane, which appeared to be one of our Morin type, overhauling it hands over fists. We were about 2,500 feet above the buses, and when within about a mile I got a glimpse of the monoplane's top wing. Black crosses on a white base. Good enough. Down went my FE's nose almost vertically, my observer standing on the wireless set, which in the normal flying position is straight up in front of the passenger seat, but in the present case was of course considerably more horizontal than the floor. 2,000 feet we came down, while the airspeed indicator went up to 160 miles per hour and then stuck, not having been designed for the purpose of exceeding recognized limits. I expected the FE to fold up under the strain any moment, but she stood it like a rock. By this time the other two machines were almost vertically below us. The Hun had caught up the B.QC, and was emptying his gun into it at 50 yards range. It subsequently transpired that just at this moment he had put three bullets in the observer's arm, and one through the main petrol tank, with the result that the precious fluid was pouring all over pilot, observer, and fuselage. I started pulling the FE out of her nose dive about 200 feet above the Hun, as too sudden a shock would inevitably have crumpled her up. The consequence was that we found ourselves above and behind the unfortunate Teuton, and within 20 yards of him. To my mind he never saw us until we opened fire. Thank the Lord, the machine gun worked, for a change. 20 rounds of lead were planted into the back of his neck, though apparently they did not hit him. He then turned his attention to us, turning left-handed and passing directly below us. This necessitated our getting onto a perpendicular bank, and doing a complete circuit to see where he'd got to. The little beggar was describing circuits round us, while we did a sort of inner circle, conducted, of course, with a perpendicular bank, but owing to the fact that our speed was so great, and that we were doing complete turns in about twice the length of our machine, the centrifugal force was so great that P couldn't hold the machine gun on its mounting. As it is hinged centrally, the heavier half being inwards, it swung down, and though the whole gun only weighs 28 pounds, he could not pull it up square. Things being at the moment at a distinctly unsatisfactory status, we weren't sorry to see the Hun head for home. After him we went, both diving lustily, while P, more familiarly known as Bongo, gave him the rest of the drum, another 28 rounds. I was beginning to get a little anxious, as we were getting very low and expecting Archie to get us any minute, when we got him. A lucky shot found its bullet, and the pilot was no more. The evolutions that machine described falling 7,000 feet with no man at the wheel were extraordinary. Viewed from above, first wheels dip, then right way again, a loop, several cartwheels, a nose dive, more loops, and several turns onto and off its back, sideways, until it was lost to sight almost on the ground. Good enough. By this time another FE, a Bristol Scout, and two CCs had arrived. But, fortunately for me, too late to claim a share in the finale. The next I remember doing was looking at my watch, 12:45. The incident over, we started climbing again, as those infernal photographs had to be done. At this point the engine began to have a say in the matter, and one cylinder decided to strike. So homeward we wended our weary way, though, I must confess, not without a frequent exchange of handshakes and chuckles. Quite an ovation on landing. The only person who wasn't cheery was the unfortunate observer of the QC who entered into the commencement of the scrap. The satisfaction of knowing that the Johnny who'd pushed three holes into his right arm, considerately avoiding to touch the bone, had been properly strafed, didn't bear any weight. However, he'd had a rotten time in the air, it wasn't to be wondered at. This little beggar we had the luck to account for had, in company with Tavia at X, given to other QCs of ours a busy time when they were on photography and reconnaissance duties, which rather mitigates the sorrow which one naturally feels for the poor beggars, whom the laws of war made our victims, though they might have been the best of fellows in themselves. The Major was delighted, as it was the first machine of this type to show up in this quarter. A number of Fokkers, as the German Marines are called, have been giving our machines a lot of trouble down south, and it is rather thought that this one may have been a picked pilot sent up to put some more heart into the other machines working in this sector of the front. For his first appearance he had certainly done remarkably well, driving off three of our machines and wounding an observer. For speed and climb, he left our machines absolutely standing, so he was well out of the way. I must say that he was the first German we have run across who put up anything like a real decent show, and our jubilation is tinged with regret at the loss of a very gallant fellow. So much for the episode itself. We got back satisfactorily to a late lunch, and soon after having entered up our report as to whether or not it was worth salving, were granted permission to go up to the wreckage. Meanwhile complications arose. An anti-aircraft ass who, as usual, knew about as much of his job as a cat does of cooking, had phoned up to the V Corps to say that a Vickers had brought down a German machine inside our lines. Number 5 Squadron, who share the aerodrome with us and have some Vickers machines, promptly came to the conclusion that to them was the credit, and sent in a claim to it to the wing headquarters. The Major's tactics were masterful. You remember, I told you that at the close of the scrap another FE, a Bristol Scout, two QCs, and sundry others arrived at the conclusion of the fracas up aloft? Well, he instructed each pilot to send in a report of what he saw. Five witnesses all round us and ample, not to say irrefutable, evidence that no Vickers had been within 10 miles of the scene all day. Result, verdict for my squadron. P, and I, with a flight sergeant from my flight and a mechanic, set out about 4 by car. We turned off the dash road just after passing dash, and left the car down a side road and waded through 12 inches of liquid mud for 300 yards to the headquarters of an artillery brigade, where they insisted on us having tea. By this time it was dark, and a mist was in the making. Thence we were directed through more seas upon seas of mud to an infantry brigade headquarters, our primary objective. Here, after considerable delay, due to the fact that one brigade was moving in and another out, we got a very poor Scotsman for guide. After that, the journey is beyond description. Words fail me when trying to portray the journey, 4 miles in the dark and a thickening mist. For a mile we kept our direction by holding one hand on a wire run along posts 3 feet high for that purpose, through woods, across fields, over trenches, jumping ditches when one could, and wading through when one couldn't. Never less than 6 inches mud, and sometimes so thick that it was impossible to shift a leg without pulling it out of the morass, by hand if you please. We thereupon struck a wooden track, known as the Russian Railway, having wooden lines with trucks worked by hand. Imagine if you can the difficulties of keeping one's footing stepping from sleeper to sleeper when they were under 4 inches of mud and water at irregular intervals and only 3 inches wide, slippery as an eel into the bargain. When you missed one, which you did every third or fourth step, if you were lucky, or every other one if you weren't, you were up to your knees or sometimes over them in the slime, without exaggerating one atom. A mile of line had been followed by this distinctly laborious method when it finally disappeared from sight altogether under a pond. A consultation which we proceeded to hold was disturbed by a mysterious creaking, much splashing, and a volume of oaths in an outlandish tongue, which I came to the conclusion was Gaelic. Behold, through the pond streamed a battalion of the Royal Scots coming out of the trenches for a rest. There being obviously nothing for it but to take the plunge, we waded knee-deep in water, and followed the direction of the track, using the various baggage trucks on the line, with their attendant perspiring Scotties, as milestones. The ground being strewn with shell holes with the regularity of a honeycomb, I was lucky to get off with 4 immersions, some members of the party faring worse. 3 miles were covered in this way, and we weren't sorry to find ourselves in a wood, covering the battalion headquarters that we had to interview. A chat and a drink of water, and even that is precious up there, and an officer volunteered to take us out to the scene of the crash. A walk of 500 yards, more mud, more water, brought us up to a line of trenches and dugouts about 100 yards from the German trenches, though screened from those nearest us by a slight rise in between. That we were in unpleasant proximity was soon apparent, as the few of the bullets came with most disturbing regularity. All the time, star shell magnesium flares went up and made you stand still as a rock, as the least movement would give one away. But by now we had reached the wreckage. As far as I gathered, viewed from the ground, the fall was full of excitement, and our troops for 4 miles along the lines had stood up and cheered to a man for several minutes on end. In fact, a few had said to the officer in command of the battalion, so he told us, that they all felt it was worth 4 days' discomfort to see it come down 7,000 feet, as the engine was going all the time, and he only took 35 seconds to drop the best part of 2 miles. You can imagine the pace it was going when it hit the ground. Finishing its descent in a nose dive, as I said, with its engine going, it first struck the top of a dugout. It would seem that fellows watching its descent, and seeing its course to be headed towards them, have taken refuge in the dugout. The roof was built of trunks of trees of reassuring dimensions, covered with 3 feet of earth. The impact was so great that, owing to the weight of the engine, it had gone slap through the roof and buried its nose into the bottom of the dugout, leaving a portion of its tail outside, but the rest so telescoped as to occupy not more than a cubic yard. Remembering the fact that this type of machine has an all-steel frame, and that behind the pilot's seat there is nothing of weight, it helps to emphasize what a colossal speed he must have been traveling. The 4 occupants of the dugout were all wounded as a result, but none seriously. One in particular lay there under the impression that he was in another world for some time. About a quarter of an hour after striking, the debris caught fire, possibly due to the shells which the Germans promptly proceeded to put over. It was then that the would-be corpse decided that a little activity might be helpful, and as he had begun to smolder, he was dropped into a convenient shell hole full of water, which restored him to his status anti-crash, if one may coin an expression. The debris was still smoldering when we got there. Of what we saw, in that dugout 10 feet by 12 feet, by the light of an electric torch through the smoke and smell, the time being midnight, and shells going off all around, I shall never forget as long as I live. Beyond repeating the official report I sent in, details would be too blood-curdling to put on paper. I don't think such a situation has been conceived in the most hair-raising novel ever written. Awful, isn't it? Shook my nerve up to a mince, but it may straighten out again soon. Personally, I couldn't stick it for more than a few minutes, and fled into the fresh air, though a particularly close few foot drove me into the trench again. A half hour's wait, while the sergeant and mechanic made a more thorough examination and traced many peculiar items of interest. As mementos of a very gruesome occasion, I have got two decoration ribbons the observer was wearing, though no medals were found. One of the ribbons is that of the Iron Cross. I have also the magneto from the engine, and a pistol for firing colored flares to range their anti-aircraft batteries on our machines, a portion of the fabric and plane, though the crosses from the wings had already been collared, and a few regimental buttons from the pilot's tunic, which we shared out to the mechanic and sergeant with us. Starting home soon after 12, the process of alternate wading, staggering, paddling, and wallowing was repeated with an increased intensity, owing to the mist having become a proper old fog. Besides getting lost several times, we did an unnecessary 4 miles, as we missed the proper turning. As you may guess, we were mighty thankful to find our tender again, and infernally fagged too. But our adventures were not at end even then. Of course we are not allowed lights out there, and we ran slap into a horse and wagon, fortunately missing the former, who proceeded to bolt into the fog in the opposite direction. More than once one wheel of the car went into a shell hole, and such a jolting as we got takes a long time to forget. You may be sure we weren't sorry to turn into the aerodrome at 2 o'clock this morning, as we hadn't had a bite for what must be easily the most eventful 12 hours of my life. Having sorted out and apportioned the relics, we turned in, and as for myself, slept like a top. Thanks so much for your letters and the magazines. I have read the article by the junior sub. Just after bye-bye. I'm afraid this is too late for tonight's post. But I thought it better to get it finished, as you may suppose I hadn't even time for a PC yesterday. Goodbye, mother dear. Thank you and Dad so much for your letters. Fondest love to all. Your loving son, Claude.